السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. This is Dr. Ali Zaini from the Weekend Islamic School, and we are doing the Islamic Studies class today. And our topic of today is Islamic criteria on judging civilization. People who say Islam is uncivilized, last time we did explain visit the condition of the world to see if it's a civilized world or not. 176 million people were killed in the previous centuries in World War II, communism, atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 72 major wars, same size. We talked about global inequality. We talked about destruction of morals. We talked about who controls this mass destruction weapons, who control the buttons. We talked about all of this to explain that the world is not really civilized as one might think. Today we're going to see the Islamic criteria in judging civilization, so that we can see how Islam views this. Think. And the first criteria is the highest value. What's the highest value of this society that controls the right and the wrong? What is right and what's wrong? Let's watch this video.
So I think we can be moral without religion.
And I'm this is about my morality.
Abortion is moral.
Culture and tradition are not good benchmarks for morality.
What is the difference between right and wrong? How do you define this? Who defines this? I'd like to start to answer these questions by quoting from a somewhat unlikely source. Here is what Ben Affleck had to say in a New York Times article recently. People with compulsive behavior, and I am one, have this kind of basic discomfort all the time that they're trying to make go away, he said. You're trying to make yourself feel better with eating or drinking or sex or gambling or shopping or whatever. But that ends up making your life worse. And then you do more of it to make that discomfort go away. Then the real pain starts. It becomes a vicious cycle you can't break. That's at least what happened to me. All of us have at times had this basic kind of discomfort or nagging feeling that the way we're behaving is wrong. And this feeling can be compounded and can grow worse with every decision we make. How do you get rid of that nagging feeling without medication, substance abuse, or escapism? First of all, in order to fix something, you need to identify the source of the problem. The problem is that most people have little idea of the cause and effect of their actions when the results are not immediate. I'm talking about the way we choose to word a white lie, or the small actions we take in personal relationships, or possibly decisions that have far more tragic results, such as whether a baby is to be kept or not. Unless we identify right and wrong actions, we will continue to fail in life, relationships, experiencing suffering, hurt, and anguish. Society tries to label right and wrong behavior under a loose moral code, but our social culture or moral code is not the benchmark for what is right and wrong. And this is why. The secular world believes that morality is relative. In other words, whatever seems right to you. The religious world, whether Christianity, Islam, or Hinduism, etc., believes that morality is determined by what God you believe in, or more precisely, what interpretation of text is used. Certain atheists such as Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins rely on science to define human values, where the result of our actions determine whether or not they are moral. Do they benefit the individual or society as a whole? That nagging feeling inside of you is often not the result of breaking society's moral code, because there is no universal agreement as to what is moral. The secularists are right at pointing this out. Most people today believe that morality is personally or socially determined, and it is defined as a set of personal or social standards for good or bad behavior and character. Many believe it can change upon the individual or social structure in place. It changes depending on the religious order too. Again, there is no universal agreement as to what is moral. Here's an example. Prior to 1962, sodomy was a crime in every US state. Since 2003, however, it is protected as an individual's private liberty throughout the United States under the Due Process Clause in the US Constitution. Over the course of just over one generation, a criminal act has become a protected right of liberty. You don't need to single out sodomy. Look at marijuana laws in countries like Canada and Uruguay, or assisted suicide in the Netherlands, Belgium, and elsewhere. Faith in science isn't going to solve a lack of emotional understanding of what is right or wrong either. Science is the newest religion on the block, as faith in a deity is quickly being abandoned in the West. The trouble is, you can't always persuade emotional people to apply reason and logic. Science is never going to prevent greed or social unrest and subsequent wars. So if the vast majority of the religious and secular world have failed to explain why we end up in emotional anguish, or just simply fail to get along, what is the answer? All of us at Tomorrow's World firmly believe that right should always be right, and wrong should always be wrong for everyone, and that morality is not fluid or defined by anyone other than God. Certain actions and behaviors will always cause hurt and pain on a spiritual level. Others cause joy and peace. These behaviors are either following or breaking spiritual laws. When you know, deep down, that what you are doing is wrong on some level and causes sadness or hurt to another, the rule you are breaking, whether you know it or not, is a spiritual law. Society's moral code does not prevent you from actions that equate to emotional self-harm. And in fact, people often go by the adage, as long as your actions didn't harm anyone else, you're free to do what you want. But that is such a destructive mindset and shows a total lack of care or concern over another individual. In the Bible, breaking spiritual law is defined as sin. In turn, sin is defined as the breaking of God's laws. Most Christians today falsely claim that this law has been done away with and replaced with something akin to a hippie mantra of acceptance, love, and goodwill. That's not what the text upon which Christianity is based says. Christianity has been gaslit into believing this, and the rest of the world aren't even close to applying God's spiritual law. We need to understand that the source of what is right and wrong is not decided upon by the individual or society. It has been determined since before time began. And if you choose to learn what is right and do what is right consistently, you will no longer suffer those nagging feelings that you're doing something wrong. You will no longer live in emotional turmoil and be subject to every false concept of morality that plagues the world. You will instead live by the perfect laws of liberty, laws that lead to peace and happiness. If you like this video, please like, comment, and subscribe. And for more content like this, please visit our website.
So basically, what is the highest value of the society that determines what's right and what's wrong? How Islam views that? What is acceptable, what's not acceptable? What is legal and what is illegal? Is idealism civilized? Okay, basically, if we base our criteria of moral values and things like that on idealism, then the society is civilized. But if it's based on materialism, then the society has a non-civilized feature. There is an illustrative example. If you go to Lake Tahoe, Lake Tahoe is divided into two regions, two portions. One is located in the state of Nevada, the other one is located in the state of California. In Nevada, prostitution and gambling are legal, okay? Because this is in California. Prostitution and gambling are legal because the economy is based on manufacturing and agriculture. While in Nevada, prostitution and gambling are legal because the economy is based on entertainment industry and tourism. There is one street in Lake Tahoe that divides Lake Tahoe into the two portions. two hotels located across the street from each other. One, prostitution and gambling, is legal, the other one is illegal. And they are right across from each other. So this is an example of how the materialism is being the highest value of the society. Economy defines moral values, not the other way around. That's an example of lack of civilization, when the economy controls the moral values, not moral values control the economy. In Islam, moral values are the same, regardless of the economy, regardless of the industry, regardless of the situation. It's always moral values are the same. No changes in the moral values in Islam. Okay. Another example of how the materialism control moral values is gambling in Evansville, Indiana. Gambling is illegal in the land. So they wanted to get around that. So what they did is that they went to the river and they have boats and made gambling there. So they said, well, it's legal in the land, but it's not illegal in the river, it's in the water. See how ridiculous it is? And this is, they are let get away with this because casino pays lots of taxes to the city. So because of the taxes, the moral values change. Third example is throw away food to keep the price up. You know, throw wheat in the ocean to keep the price of wheat up. That is immoral, but economy overrides, the price overrides the moral value here. Grocery stores, they to keep the price of things high, they don't reduce their price. So if it, let's say for chicken, for example, they don't sell you the chicken, or they don't give the chicken at the end of the day, the remaining chicken in a charity. No, they throw it away. And they don't sell it for a lower price. Why? Because they say, no, we want to keep the price. So we throw away the extra instead of being it reduced. And then that would reduce the price of the chicken, for example. That's another example. That's why we end up throwing away 200 tons of food every day from the open buffets in Las Vegas, and instead of using it in a moral fashion to feed the hungry in the area. But there are two extremes when dealing with materialism here. The extreme of neglecting its importance and clashing with it, and the extreme of making it the highest value of the society that governs everything, morality. Islam is the middle. Islam recognizes the importance of materialism, but makes idealism the governing highest value in life that controls moral values, that controls right and wrong, okay? People may use materialism in choosing between different alternatives, but if an issue is determined to be immoral, then it doesn't matter how much materialistic benefits it brings. That's it, it's immoral. Materialistic benefits in these cases are treated as evil temptations, okay? And materialistic values that control moral values. So that's the first criteria Islam uses to judge civilization. The second criteria is the source of legislation. Okay, if the society is divided into two groups, one write laws and one, the higher people write laws and the lower people follow these laws, then this society has a non-civilized feature, okay? Because people are slaves of the laws. So if part of the society, small segment of the society, write these laws, but the rest of the society became slave of these laws, then this is an uncivilized feature. But if the guidance from God, Allah, is the source of major laws and legislation, then this society is a civilized society. And this includes, of course, the laws enforced by the governing body, the written laws, or the unwritten laws enforced by the social pressure and the society itself. Allah is the only one who can make laws that are fair to everyone. Man-made laws are made to serve a specific segment of the society. So, for example, capitalism is based on selfishness and greed to serve the people who own the capital, okay? And so forth. The moral values are determined by Allah, And if the moral values are determined by other than Allah, then it would be like the small segment of the society that make the laws. They are playing the role of God in making laws that everybody else is slave of these laws. So that is a sign of your, let's say, society has a non-civilized feature if it is that way. The third criteria is role of women. So let's see this video about the role of women. What? That's not fair. Oh, yeah. The K is not highlighted in the link. Is it capital K? Yes, small K.
All right, before the break, I asked career moms, if you can afford not to work and are in a two-parent home, do you think that it's selfish to work anyway? Let's get some answers from our guests, Amy Finley, Monica Kirsch, and Laura Somoza. Do you think it's selfish? No, Amy, no.
I don't think anyone ever asks a male that same question.
I agree with you. Laura?
I agree with you, but I don't think it's fair to give a blanket judgment. I think you have to look at each scenario case by case, because some people may have smaller jobs, some people may have a job that gives them some self-esteem, something that broadens their life in some way.
Right, so would it be accurate to say that one of the things we're sort of all saying here is that women should be free to choose?
Sure.
We agree with that?
It would be ideal if women were free to choose.
Okay, be ideal if women were free to choose.
I agree with that.
Having it all may be unrealistic all at once, but at least some women can do it in stages if they choose so.
What if you don't even want it all?
Fine, good. I think Monica
sometimes
was...
Sometimes it depends on what your definition of all
is. I was going to say, maybe having it all is staying at home with your kids.
Yeah.
Well, here, let me give you a piece of data. Here's a study by the Biomedical Library of the University of Minnesota. They showed that children of mothers who work 30 or more hours a week lag developmentally. That's a pretty vague notion, lagging developmentally. But I think what they're going at here is that when there's not sufficient attention from the gene pool, something happens. Monica, you wanted to say something about that.
Yeah, I look at it every day with my 14-month-old daughter. When she discovers something for the first time, she looks to see my validation for that. She looks for me. She wants to know that I'm proud of her. She's proud of herself. You know, if she's in a daycare all day with none of that one-on-one attention, she's going to say, wow, we did something. Okay, I don't know if it was that great or not. You know, I don't know.
Well, I think that's great in theory, but I think you have to remember, too, that there's so many people that just don't have those options.
Right,
there's so many people that have to work that,
choosing.
But what would be nice to know is if we could come up with a number of you need to spend so many hours a day focusing on that child for them to be healthy and attached.
But is it, again, is it that a mother needs to spend so many hours a day, or is it just that they need to have a dedicated caretaker who spends that sort of, that FaceTime, that smiling interaction, all of those things?
I think the first 5 years are the most important, and I feel that if a child is away from a sole caregiver, they develop attachment issues later in life. Maybe Dr. Drew, it turns into addiction.
Oh, for sure. People that have ambivalent and disturbed attachments, they're at risk for addiction. There's no doubt about that. We have a phone call before we go on here. Marguerite from Illinois, what do you want to say to the group?
I had a career as a rehabilitation aide, and I decided after our second son that I'd just stay at home with them. And I guess my thing is, you know, I gave up the career to stay at home, and I love every minute of it, but there's always messes being made or things to clean or cook or appointments to get to. So I lack social communication for being a stay-at-home mom, but at the same time, children are like sponges from birth to 5 years, so they soak up everything, and I would rather them be there with me to be influencing them in good decisions instead of outside influences.
All right.
So I guess...
Got it. What do you guys say to that?
Well, in part, I think that, you know, one, I don't know of a parent who is lazy in terms of deciding who their children's going to be around, you know, including, you know, my sister works, my mother actually held two jobs for a lot of my life, and I know that they all really, really agonized over the choices about who to leave their children with. It's not a casual decision ever, I don't think, for a woman we don't drop our child off on the corner and say, you know, I'm sure you're going to be fine
with
this person.
You didn't put him in a basket and leave him somewhere?
No. There's a lot of due diligence involved in finding a great person.
Monica, you have something to say about that?
Well, I think that Amy, it's very well put that it's, you know, hopefully not a decision that people take lightly. I mean,
you're a teacher, though.
Yes.
And you're, what age group do you teach?
Second grade.
Did you see a lot of inattentiveness to that issue?
Of course. I mean, there, you know, another thing that I dealt with was that they're with so many different people. Let's say if they go from mom to grandma to teacher to nanny, there's so many sets of rules. These children become confused. They don't know what they're doing is right or wrong because with one person it's right, with another person it's wrong. And they get, you know, conflicted within themselves, and they end up with, you know, low self-esteem and
Laura?
Lack confidence.
You know, I have to say, from all the women that I know that are mothers, and they say that even if they are stay-at-home moms or they do work, the one thing I'd say is that there's still never enough time. They're always going to have a sense of guilt for not doing it enough. And so you can sit here as much as you want and say, like, you know, we have to be here from a certain time, but you, people are always going to feel like they make mistakes. People are always going to feel like they should have done it better in some way.
Let's get a Facebook question. I think it's kind of interesting that this whole conversation about women and career goes back to being a mom. It just, you don't see men having the same conversation about career and dad. You just don't see it. Career moms, do you ever feel guilty putting your desires before your desires for career before your child's best interest? I think that's what we're talking about here. And I think, Laura, you said everybody would feel that guilt.
Yeah, absolutely.
Monica, no?
I would hope so.
Maybe.
I think you keep peeling the onion. Because, I mean, when you're talking about a child's best interest, another thing that's in the child's best interest is having a stable home,
a
loving marriage,
yeah.
a happy mom,
yes.
you know, two parents who have a good and tight and communicative relationship. And I know a lot of women who that becomes possible because they also feel that self, that sense of self that comes from, I trained for this, I went to school for this, this is my professional career, this is sort of me, you know, my journey of self-discovery.
Yeah, having a well-rounded sense of self.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is a great thing for a child too, and should
Absolutely.
We be making
and then you're a role model as well,
right? We should model that to our
and
children.
Should women be thinking about sacrificing? I think we had real guidelines about how much time here, how much time there. It'd be much. We don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't
really
have that though. A personal reveal: my wife stayed at home. I have triplets who are 18, who are fantastic. They would not be who they are. I would not be who I am had she not done this. Just mm-hmm. I get choked up thinking about it. Thank you, honey, for mm-hmm. doing that. But now they're going off to school, and you know she's trying to figure out who she is in the world and wants to move on. For her, it was about, I think, stages. Is that a good option for many women, do you
yeah.
think? Do it in stages?
I think so. I think there's a lot of women that have, you know, careers for a long period of time and then become mothers now. I think there's a lot of women that are having children later on in life.
And vice versa,
okay, yeah.
having their careers. Hang on, we've got a statistic here. Okay. 67% of women say having children and staying at home when they're young is an important choice for them. So being young, having kids, let's face it, I hear women my age talking about how the biological drive diminishes too. Mm-hmm. So when you're younger, there's sort of this push to reproduce and be a mom, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't there?
Sure.
That's biological.
Right.
Yeah,
well, no, and I think that, you know, I know for me, I was always sort of counting 8 years into the future, 18 years into the future, too, to sort of imagine, well, where am I going to be sort of at the end of this process, too?
Mm-hmm. You know, which is good, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I had my first child when I was 28.
You don't want to lose yourself into the kids, and then where are you?
Mm-hmm. Well, and you were talking about stages. That's actually, I think, the thing that becomes difficult sometimes, too. You know, when you have a career, I had a professional career. I was cooking. I stopped, I stayed home, and the longer you see that gap opening up, you do have those realistic worries about,
going
am
back.
I going to be able to
yep.
go back?
Yep.
Am I still marketable in my same field?
Okay, so the role of women is another criteria Islam uses to judge civilization. Well, Islam recognized that the main role of the women is to produce a human being. This is more honorable than any other role. And including the role of a man. A man produces a product, which is materialistic product, bridge, building, road, chair, tuna can, Pepsi can. These are all products of men who materialistic products. And these are no way compared to the product of women, which is living human being. Like they say, it's a sponge from the up to the age of 5 that needs mama to guide and to care for so that it gets the right environment that helps him or her grow to be a healthy member of the society. Sometimes a woman would abandon her job as a mother but works as servant in restaurants, airplanes and things like that. So if this is the case, then the society is uncivilized. If the society, if the mother abandons their jobs, then this is a sign of non-civilized society, or that's a sign, that's a non-civilized feature in a society. Okay, so that's very important criteria in Islam. The fourth criteria in Islam in judging civilization is the building unit of the society. What is the building unit of the society?
The nuclear family is the single most important institution in any society. Without it, our very existence would quickly become jeopardized. Yet there are some who are attempting to break down the family, and by doing so, their efforts are an attack on humanity. Here are three reasons why the family unit is fundamental to society. Reason number one, the family provides for children. Research conducted by health professionals provides ample evidence demonstrating that a married couple is statistically better equipped when compared to cohabiting couples or single-parent families to provide a more favorable home for the development of children. For example, a medical paper by Wendy D. Manning titled Cohabitation and Child Well-being stated the following on health. At birth, children born into cohabiting parent families are more likely to have low birth weight than are their counterparts born to married parents, and more often experience asthma, obesity, and poor health than do children born to married parents. On finance, the median income of cohabiting parent households is about 50% lower than that of married parent households, and cohabiting mothers of young children have lower incomes than do married mothers. On behavior, children born to cohabiting parents have more problems with peers, more aggressive behaviors, more internalizing problems, and more negative teacher assessments than do children born to married parents. Instability, then, appears to harm psychosocial well-being. You can review the paper and supporting studies by following the link in the description. But the takeaway is that the primary purpose of a healthy family unit is to provide a home, afford protection, and support the general well-being of children. Without the nuclear family, the necessary regeneration of society would ultimately collapse. The home, when carefully balanced with a loving father and mother, is at its most advantageous, and it forms the bedrock from which sound-minded children can be raised. Learned values are passed on from one generation to the next. By both example and word, parents must raise their children to know how to live and interact with others. Reason number two, the family benefits a child's education. Professor of Sociology at Princeton University, Sarah McClanahan, herself a single parent for 10 years, was part of the Fragile Families and Child Wellbeing Study, which examined the differences between 5,000 children who had grown up in either a single parent or two parent home. Dr. McClanahan revealed in a BBC article that children who were in what the researchers characterized as a fragile family, where parents were cohabiting or there was a lone parent, were twice as likely not to graduate from high school. The data showed that even a child in a stable single-parent household was likely to do worse on some measures than a child of a married couple. In an earlier paper found in volume 56 of the American Sociological Review, of which McClanahan was a co-author, the statistically unfavorable results in education for single-parent homes was highlighted as a considerable concern for the government, as education is a key factor in long-term economic success. The paper explains that the primary reason for lower educational attainment in these cases is due to single-parent homes suffering from income insecurity. Reason number three, the family provides for the local community and the nation. On both a national and a local community level, governments would do well to support and invest in the nuclear family, as statistically it is the most successful institution in which future generations are developed. The beneficial results from well-behaved, well-educated, and stable children is not confined within the walls of a home. Society as a whole benefits from children who grow up to be successful and have a greater sense of purpose than their own existence. Canadian author William D. Gairdner probably says it best when he wrote, "In the pure financial sense, the family is the original and still unequaled charitable organization of the world. No state could possibly match its contribution to the education, health, or moral training of its members, nor could it supply the young of the world with the equivalent in financial assets transferred from generation to generation." Research confirms that no other institution will care for the well-being of children like a family unit. Good parents must be unequivocally invested in the life of their children. Yet since the days of Plato, philosophers and politicians have been suggesting ways in which the state can raise children in an attempt to subvert the traditional family. In Book 5 of his Republic, Plato wrote the following: "Children are to be common, and no parent is to know his own child, nor any child his parent." The state-driven preferential ideas of Plato were passed on to French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau and then to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. As a result, communism, and by default socialism, has probably been the greatest all-time net contributor to the breakdown of the family. Engels was clear in his desire to see traditional roles of husband and wife, as well as parent and child, entirely erased from society. The first condition for the liberation of the wife is to bring the whole female sex back into public industry, and that this in turn demands that the characteristic of the monogamous family as the economic unit of society be abolished. For some reason, the family is being attacked by key elements of society, and in doing so, our Western nations are unraveling. We need to carefully consider the benefits a family provides and choose, based on scientific observation, statistical analysis, and biblical wisdom, the best way forward for humanity. Choose life, that both you and your descendants may live. For more information, please request our special report on the future of the family. Visit.
So, the building unit of the family. If this is a judging criteria from Islam to judge the civilization, if the building unit of the society is a healthy family, then made of, like they call it, the nuclear family, then this is a caring family, caring father, loving mother, married. This provides, and they have legitimate children, then this provides a stable and strong unit that the society is built from these blocks. Each block is a nuclear family. But if the population of the children is based on illegitimate children, families of single fathers, single mothers, two fathers and two mothers, which are the homosexual families, this society has a non-civilized feature. In US, female ages between 15 and 19 years, 750 births in the year 2000 to about 250,000 in the year 2014. Okay. No statistics on miscarriage abortion, so that does not include miscarriage and abortion. 39% go to bed the first date, when it is when the first date, when they are strangers still, they just go to bed. The US in 1965, 24% will go to bed on the first date. And in 1990, 64% that will do the same thing. More than half of the babies in United Kingdom from outside of wedlock. Okay, so we believe in the equality between men and women, but the loser in the liberal relationship outside of marriage is the girl, if she or the woman. If she's deserted, if she's aborted, or end up as a single mother, she is the loser and the family is the loser. Now, Muslims nation, honestly, are doing the best in this area. No girl would allow a guy to take advantage of her, okay? So it's not like no girl is going to be an idiot to give herself up to a guy just like that. Islam provides lines of defense against adultery to protect the family. So these lines of defense are hijab, shyness. Boys and girls can't be alone in a private place. It doesn't matter what, even if he's teaching her Quran. The distance, there is a social distance, socially safe distance between men and women, boys and girls. If this social distance is violated, then the possibility of romance increases. I mean, these lines of defense protect against adultery, because if you're running 60 miles an hour and you have to stop at the edge of the cliff, it's impossible. But these lines of defense in Islam works like reducing the speed from 60 to 50 to 40 to 30 to 20 to stop at the edge of the cliff so that you don't fall into the cliff. If we allow boys and girls to swim together, to date, to be away, alone in private places, and all of these things without the proper dress, what else do we expect? It's just like adultery becomes unavoidable in these cases. And that's why Islam provides a very good approach to resistance of adultery to protect the family. Okay, and there is a saying about that, taking advantage of women. Okay, why buy the cow if you can get the milk for free? That concept to make girls cheaper. I've seen when I was living in Indiana, a girl with a naked dress in a very, very cold night. Very cold night, snowing, I was shivering, and she was wearing almost a naked dress. Because she wanted to get a date. And, you know, she's wearing something to attract men to get a date. And there was, I also saw a girl dating a married guy, spending her money on, he takes her money away. And when she is told by my wife that you deserve better than that, you are much more precious than that, she said, "You sound like my mother. You can't find better than that." In Muslim countries, girls are precious because no free milk is, because of many, many reasons. Among them is that no free milk is offered. About the out-of-luck progeny, we can see this video.
Americans appear to be reversing their views on having babies out of wedlock. In 2002, 45% felt it was morally acceptable. Well, now 61% say it's acceptable. Reverend Jennifer Crumpton is a political commentator, author of the new book, Femme Evangelical. Did I say that right?
Yes, you
okay.
did.
The Modern Girl's Guide to the Good News, Vera Gibbons, personal finance expert, and Jacqueline Newman is a family and marriage law attorney. Great group to analyze this. Ladies, welcome. So, Jacqueline, let me start with you, because from an attorney's point of view, do you see a lot of couples who come in to see you who might have children, but they're not married? You seen on that side of things too?
I'm seeing a lot of that. A lot of people are coming in now, they want, you know, just parenting agreements. We have a lot of people that are doing the Goldie Hawn, Kurt Russell relationships, and I think that it's really becoming much more of a trend.
What are the downsides to that?
There are downsides to it. From a financial standpoint, if anything, there are marital rights that you get when you're ultimately married. So when you have somebody, let's say a non-moneyed spouse who comes in and doesn't want to get married, they're married, they're together for a long time, they're raising children, sacrificing their careers, and then they ultimately break up, and that person might not be eligible, will not be eligible for spousal support.
The problem I have with this is that the people who are doing it predominantly are low-income people, not that educated, and they're setting their kids off, they're bringing the kids into the world like at a total disadvantage.
You're talking about a totally different thing than what she's
yes,
saying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So I think. Well, I know why people are getting married later for any number of reasons, because they haven't found the right spouse, right, or they don't have the right, they're not financially
right,
ready for it.
Right, but you're talking from an economic point of view.
From an economic point of view.
That you worry that a high percentage of these women are not, they're just having babies on their own. They're
That's
not
what I
in
worry
a committed
about.
Relationship.
Right. I know a lot of the babies that are coming to this world are coming out of committed relationships.
Right.
People just live together. But those dissolve much faster than marriages. So that's what I'm concerned about.
Mm-hmm. I think that people are realizing that while marriage provides legal and social protections, it doesn't automatically mean that people are good parents. What I think we're seeing
That's
in this
right.
poll is a shift in the definition of morality in America. People are asking, is morality really just a blanket enforcement of old rules, or is a moral society one that works together to non-judgmentally and open-mindedly solve our most intractable problems? Mm-hmm. And I think people are catching on to the fact that marriage and morality doesn't necessarily equal healthy, happy families, as evidenced by the Duggars. Uh-huh. There was sexual abuse and incest going on with the picture of the pinnacle of morality.
Right. I think one of the issues that a lot of people will think, though, about this study is fatherless homes.
Right.
And back to your point, maybe, Vera, that
that if you're not in a committed relationship and you're having children, there's all kinds of studies that say that that's not necessarily beneficial to the child.
That's my problem that I was trying to get at. It's not beneficial for the child. They have more emotional problems, behavioral problems. They tend to take a similar path where they're not able to make any money down the line. They go into poverty, whatever the case may be. So that's my concern, is just the disadvantages that the children are at when you have these low-income people who are not financially savvy or don't have the financial acumen. Those are the kids that they're bringing in.
It's interesting, I just want to bring out this fact and figure, because the first poll we showed is how people's mindset is changing. But the actual percent of U.S. births to unmarried women has gone up a lot. 2002, 34% of all births. 2013, 40.6% of all births in the U.S. unmarried. That's an amazing stat to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're seeing that because women are more economically and socially and politically empowered now, and I think that's a good thing. There are women who are making decisions because they can't find the right mate or they can't find somebody responsible enough, who are Christian women even, who are going into their 40s.
It'd be interesting to see, though, the percentage of that. Of the 40.6%, I would love to know what percentage of that are, you know, highly educated working women who are making that choice.
That's what I think, and I think that what's going on now is that women are having jobs, they're getting married later in life, and they're freezing eggs, they're doing all sorts of things, and I think that is ultimately they're putting themselves in a situation where they don't need a man to ultimately have children.
But the two-parent household is still better for the kids.
But if you look back at marriage historically, it was started as an institution where families sold their girls or traded their girls to men that they didn't want to be with in order to be childbearers and produce progeny. So marriage has changed a lot. Families have changed a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of bumps and starts, but for the most part, I think humanity senses that changes in the family structure and the way things are with marriage can be a good thing if we focus on that.
It's very interesting to look at how we change and what our thoughts are as time goes on. Ladies, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, you may know him, speaking of time going on.
So basically, it enforces the idea that it actually emphasized the idea that the nuclear family and the out-of-lock wedding, the birthes, is a sign of lack of civilization. The out-of-wedlock birth. And still, the nuclear family is the best for the children. Okay. The basis of unity. If the unity of the society, is a materialistic basis of unity, which is like rich, comfortable, fulfilling life, materialistic income, this is a sign of lack of civilization. So, if the unit member of the society, if the value that unites the society are common moral values and common ideology and views of life based on heavenly guidance, then this society is civilized. United based on the Ten Commandments, for example, united based on faith, the basis of unity, that's a civilized society. But if this society is united over materialistic and common materialistic interest, such as the rich, comfortable, fulfilling life that we live in and that we love, want our children to be, then the society has a non-civilized feature. And the earthly basis of units is the mud, based on mud. So it's based on the race, which is the race is coming from mud. So if you base the unit on the mud, values coming from the mud, like the race and things like that, then that's an earthly basis of unity, which is a sign of lack of civilization. But if the basis of unity is heavenly, coming from heaven, like the Ten Commandments, like the faith, then the basis of unity is heavenly, and that is a sign of a civilized society. And the final criteria is to judge civilization in Islam is the inequalities.
People are talking a lot about inequality these days, about the fact that the richest 1% have so much more than everybody else. But most of the focus seems to be on the United States, and it strikes me that the same story needs to be told about global inequality too. So I did some research, and this is what I found from reliable sources like the UN. It turns out that while the US is totally out of whack, things are actually way worse for the planet as a whole. Let's start with this graph. a perfectly even distribution of wealth among all living people, with everyone divided into five equal groups. Now, let's show how much each group actually has. Shocking, right? 80% of the world's people barely have any wealth. It's hard to even see them on the chart. Meanwhile, the richest 2%, they have more wealth than half of the rest of the world. Let's look at this chart another way. Let's take the whole world's population, all 7 billion of us, and reduce it to just a representative 100 individuals. Here they are, poorest people on the left, richest people on the right. Now let's show how the world's total wealth, roughly $223 trillion, is distributed. The vast majority have practically nothing. Nothing with which to educate their children, nothing with which to pay for basic medicines. While the richest 1%, they've accumulated 43% of our world's wealth. The bottom 80%, meanwhile, that's 8 out of every 10 people, have just 6% between them. But even this doesn't really show how extreme things have become. The richest 300 people on Earth have the same wealth as the poorest 3 billion. So the number of people it takes to fill a mid-sized commercial aircraft have more wealth than the populations of India, China, the US, and Brazil combined. We can also see this difference geographically, with a huge and growing gap between a few rich places versus the majority of the world. For most of history, things were much more equal. 200 years ago, rich countries were only 3 times richer than poor countries. By the end of colonialism in the 1960s, they were 35 times richer. Today, they're about 80 times richer. Rich countries try to compensate for this by giving aid to poor countries, about $130 billion each year. That's a lot of money. So then why does the wealth gap keep getting bigger? One reason I found is that large corporations are taking more than $900 billion out of poor countries each year through a form of tax avoidance called trade mispricing. On top of this, each year poor countries are paying about $600 billion in debt service to rich countries on loans that have already been paid off many times over. And then there's the money that poor countries lose from trade rules imposed by rich countries to get access to more resources and cheaper labor. Economists from the University of Massachusetts calculate that this costs poor countries about $500 billion a year. Altogether, that's more than $2 trillion that flows from some of the poorest parts of the world to the richest. Every year. Rich governments like to say they're helping poor countries develop. But who's developing who here? This makes me think that there's something wrong with the basic rules of the global economy. It can't be okay that the wealth of our planet is becoming so concentrated in the hands of such a tiny number of people. The only reasonable response, it seems to me, and our only hope, is to change the rules.
So that's another criteria that Islam uses for globalization, is the difference in income and difference in the distribution of wealth and power. If they are concentrated in the hands of few, then this is a sign of lack of civilization. That's a big sign of lack, severe lack of civilization. But if it is distributed in such a mild way, it's inequality, they would have to be inequality, but mild inequality, reasonable inequality, natural inequality is something. And what we have seen there is some, in this video, is something else. And that is on the sixth criteria that Islam uses to judge civilization. And the question today, are we truly civilized? Are we truly civilized or not? Okay, so any questions?